vector. There are other ways of having column vectors. Let's try something else. Let's go back here and let's try to say a W is equal to 1.0. I think that's how it works. Eric, is that correct?
Maybe it's a comma. I don't know what you want to do.
We get a column. Yeah, that's a column vector, right?
Yes.
So if I put a comma, would that work?
Yes, that would also work.
In the same way?
Yes.
Okay, that's confusing. Okay, so comma, well, you have many options. Very good. So the idea is that we can work with column vectors and row vectors, and they are different objects. They are all cases of arrays, though. All right, and now we're going to create some, what is this? A random column vector, just by using random, okay, of length 4, 1, with imaginary part. All right, so in this way we can create vectors, and now the question is, can we compute the scalar product? And so we've created two vectors. We can access, this one is how we access a given component. That's clear, okay? Component, second component of the vector. And now we can ask also the scalar product. Now, how do we compute the scalar product? We take a column vector times a row vector. But in Julia, this does not give us a number. It gives us an array, 1 times 1 array, okay? So this might be confusing sometimes. You just need to get used to it. And so this scalar product ends up being 1 times 1 array. If you really want the number inside, you just need to ask for it, okay? Very good. So now we want to compute the square root of this scalar product or another, or say we want to compute a norm, we just take the square root of the scalar product of W with W, and so on. All right, so we've seen numbers, we've seen vectors. Let's go to matrices, which is what we really want. So here's how you could build a matrix. You just input directly the entries. You can see that 1, 2, 3 appear as the first column, second column, third column. We can also create a matrix by taking the outer product of.
I think it's the other way around. I think it's row by row.
Oh, look how smart. I've chosen a symmetric matrix. Okay, so let's test that. Very good, thanks, Eric. What happens now? There you are, row by row. Right, this is the first row. I think we can go to Pearson and delete 5 seconds. Okay. So yeah, we can take the outer product of a way to build a matrix from a vector is just to multiply a row vector times a column vector. That's what we're doing here. And what else? Then, we can create a random matrix. There are different functions to create random numbers, so I guess we can put an n there as well. It will work. Yeah. So what's the difference between rand and rand? Okay, I think that's normally distributed, is that right? This is between 0 and 1, and this is normally distributed, or?
I thought rand n is for creating vectors and matrices, and rand is just for scalars.
All right. That's a hypothesis. Yeah, it's normally distributed or flat, no? Yeah.
One. Yeah. Another deviation one, sorry.
Okay, so n is normal?
So n is normal.
And the other one is flat. this
uniform,
plot.
Yes.
Uniform.
Okay, very good.
See, we learned something. Okay, good. So now we've created some metrics. If we want it to be Hermitian conjugate, so we will be working with Hamiltonians. Hamiltonians are matrices that are Hermitian conjugate. Okay, so if you take the transpose and complex conjugation, you get back the same metric. So we can try to do that here. First, we compute the Hermitian conjugate by, if M is a matrix, M prime is going to be the Hermitian conjugate. And so the practical way of creating random Hermitian matrices is just by adding together the matrix and its Hermitian conjugate, divide by 2. Okay, and so you can see that the entries, the diagonal entries, are real. The imaginary part is 0. And that this of the diagonal entry here is the complex conjugate of this of the diagonal matrix, okay? Entry. So we have a Hermitian matrix. Very good. So now we are ready for the eigenvalue decomposition. Once we have a Hermitian matrix, that would be our Hamiltonian. We would like to find its eigenvalues and eigenvectors. And for that, in Julia, we need to use linear algebra. Now, you may have to install that at linear algebra if you haven't done it yet. And here is a single function, eigen of m, which will produce the eigenvalue decomposition. Let me stop for a second here. Let me see what I want to say. So most of you know what an eigenvalue decomposition is, but let's set the notation. So given a matrix which we will assume to be Hermitian, okay, we will want to decompose it as the product of a unitary matrix, a diagonal matrix with real entries, and another and the unitary matrix conjugate. So here U is unitary. And D is diagonal with entries, real, with real entries, diagonal entries. And so this one unitary means that U dagger is equal to U dagger U equal to the identity. Okay? And so this is called the eigenvalue decomposition of the matrix. Okay. Question?
Because M is huge, so is eigenvalue decomposition better or singular value decomposition better? I know mathematically that is
better.
Better in terms of?
In terms of?
In terms of computation.
So better means faster?
Yeah.
Yeah, but it really depends on what you want, if you want the singular values or the eigenvalues.
But I think
they are different objects.
But I think they are the same for
Hermitian. It is true that the singular values and the eigenvalues, yeah, for a Hermitian matrix.
I just want to know which one is better.
Oh, okay. So, well, let me say, though, that this is already a singular value decomposition, but there are other singular. So I don't know which one is better. I'm guessing that Julia will decide what's the, so if you ask for the eigenvalue decomposition and it's equivalent to the singular value decomposition, I would assume that Julia would use the singular value decomposition to give you the eigenvalue decomposition. So if it detects that it's a Hermitian matrix, there will be some choice being made there.
Are you saying that the algorithm for SVD and the eigen is the same?
No. I'm saying that Julia. So if you declare the matrix to be Hermitian, and you now ask for eigenvalues, and if it was faster to just compute the singular values, I'm assuming that Julia would do that. But I don't know. Do you have any comment, Eric?
I know that in some cases Julia calculates singular values by taking the square of the matrix or something similar, and then calculating eigenvalues.
So maybe eigenvalues are faster?
I don't know. It's just a
So the honest answer is I have no idea. Next question. But in any case, the cost scales in the same way with the size of the matrix, if it's a square matrix as we have here. So maybe there is some difference in the cost, but we know that it scales as the third power of the linear size of the matrix. All right, so let's look at this function. This we can call eigen of m, and the result, what we obtain is might be complicated, but you can see it here. It's an array. That's a vector, okay? A vector with three entries. That's actually the eigenvalues. And we're storing it in here in D. And then there is, then we get the eigenvectors, which would be, there are three eigenvectors, so we get a matrix containing each column corresponds to an eigenvector. Now, what do you do if you don't trust what I say? Well, what you want to do is to actually test whether these elements in vector D. Okay, what happened here? Oh, I see. Using. All right, we got this. Now we have a vector U. A vector D. I claim that these are the eigenvalues. We have a matrix U. I claim that these are the eigenvectors. And so what we can do is directly test whether this is the eigenvalue decomposition by multiplying U times D times U. But of course, here, what I'm calling there D is just the diagonal entries. So we will need to write a diagonal matrix with entries D. So let's do that. Insert above. So remember D at this point is just this. So how do we produce a diagonal matrix with entries D in the diagonal? So let's try this one. Okay, there you have it. Okay? So you play around with this. This just says that it should be in the diagonal. If we change 0 to a 1, it will offset. We instead put a 1 here. Let's see. I didn't mean to do that. Sorry. This one here. OK? Right. So what happens is it produced, we lose the input. So it's produced a matrix, square matrix, okay, with the diagonal elements offset, right? So if I put a minus one here, this will appear down there. And you can play around with this. It's a quick way of producing diagonal or similar matrices. So if I was to put a minus one here, you see what has happened, okay? So that's the way to produce a diagonal matrix. And now we're ready to ask the question whether n, the multiplying u times this diagonal matrix times u dagger, has anything to do with the original matrix. So for this purpose, I display both m, which is the original matrix, and the result of u diagonal u times d times u dagger. I have it here. And now you can compare entry by entry and confirm that they are the same. Okay, so that's how I would go about checking whether this function is doing what I wanted. All right, any questions? So if you have a very big matrix, obviously checking entry by entry is not the smart way to go. Comparing entry by entry, but what you could do is you could display directly the difference between m and n, or even compute the norm of the difference. And so if you display the matrix that is m minus n, you'll see that all the elements are 10 to the minus 15 or 16. And if you compute the norm, you get also a very small norm. So that means that m and n are the same matrix up to machine precision. All right, so what else do we want to know? So what we will be doing in practice is build this huge Hamiltonian, which will be a Hermitian matrix. That will be the Hamiltonian of our quantum spin chain. And once we have this Hamiltonian, we'll try to look for the ground state, which is the eigenstate with the lowest energy, and try to study properties of this eigenstate. Okay? So we need to get used to identifying what's the lowest energy eigenstate and so on. So that's what we can do by looking and say, remember we had some, let's plot it here. Let's remind ourselves of what D was. D contained the eigenvalues. And what's the smallest eigenvalue here? It's the first one, right? So it's somehow the eigen function diagonalizes, organizes the eigenvalues from small to large. This seems to be the case. And then, so minus two is the smallest one. And so this would correspond to the lowest energy state. So that's the guy we want. And we want the corresponding eigenvector. So we can call this eigenvalue 1, just the first entry of D. And the first eigenvector will be, I don't know why this is so unstable, it keeps changing. In any case, this will give us the first eigenvector. Okay? So we take the matrix U and we look at the first eigenvector. Very good. So with that, now we want to check whether it's indeed true that we take, if we multiply this eigenvector times the matrix, we get back the same eigenvector times the eigenvalue. And so how do we check this equality? We just display the result of the right-hand side and the result of the left-hand side. And there we are. We get the same result. All right? Good. So this was just a very basic introduction to how to deal with matrices and eigenvalue decompositions. So I would encourage you to play around as you need it. The next step, what we want to do here is to talk about diagonalizing a quantum spin chain. So let me now remind you of what we need from quantum mechanics. This is very different from the previous two modules, based on statistics or on integrating partial differential equations. So what do we need about quantum mechanics? Remember, what we will be dealing with is quantum spin chains. So if we have a quantum spin, I'm going to assume it's quantum spin 1/2. So there are two orthogonal states you can find it in. But more generally, it can be in a linear superposition of these two up state and down state, where A and B are complex numbers. Okay? So if we wanted to study just one spin, we would use a vector of complex numbers to encode A and B. Okay? And if we have one spin, it's important to know, well, we may want to attach or to write matrices for Hermitian operators in the theory. And so a nice basis is given by the identity. And then the Pauli matrices. And so this is going to be sigma x is this matrix. Sigma y, which is this one, and sigma z. Okay. Good. So the trick with quantum mechanics is that if instead of having one quantum spin, you have two quantum spins, then you have to deal, so let's go to two quantum spins. Then now, a basis of states is the tensor product of individual bases And then general wave function would be linear combination of these guys. So let me write it as alpha, up, up, plus beta, up, down, gamma, down, up, delta, up, down, okay? And so if we wanted to study two quantum spins, we would be, the state of two quantum spins, we would be using a vector, vector of complex numbers of dimension 4, more generally, the rule is that we have a tensor product. I'm just going to have problems with space now. So there is no way of displaying this one and the next one. OK. So remember the tensor product? Of this, for n equal to 2, for two spins, we just say that the vector space is the tensor product of two copies of the vectors product of the vector space for one spin. I'll just delete this, right? So now imagine that you have the two spins. One is in state A, B. These are two complex numbers. The other one is in state C and D. And you would like to express this as a single vector in this tensor product. So what you have to do is you have to take tensor product of these two guys. And what that means is A times C, D, B times C, D, OK? So you go through the first one, A, then B, and you multiply by the vector on the other side. So this is AC, AD, BC, BD. And this will be the components alpha, beta, gamma, delta. OK? So that's the rule, the composition rule. And so in Julia, this will be done by a function called cron. From Kronecker product. Good. So the same way that we can take the tensor product of vectors, we may want to take the tensor product of matrices, and that's what's represented there. So imagine now that we have the sigma z acting on the first spin, tensor identity acting on the second spin. So this, we want to regard this as a 4 times 4 matrix. Okay, so how do we go from here? How do we write this as a 4 times 4 matrix? Well, we just go through the entries. Let me change this to sigma x. Okay, so again, what we do is we go through the first entry, we put it here, and then we multiply by sigma x. It goes through the second entry, and multiply by sigma x. This gives us a 0. And minus sigma x. Okay, you see what I'm doing? I'm just going through these different entries, and for each entry, I multiply that entry by sigma x. And I write it like this. So now let me write the big matrix. Of course, this meant 4 zeros. And this will be the tensor product. So this is called the Kronecker product. For Julia. And the idea is that we usually just write this. Okay, we'll say sigma z times sigma x. But what we mean is this. We need, in Julia, we'll have, well, when we try to put this in a computer, we'll have to write to build a whole matrix. All right, so more generally, this is the expression, right? So you have matrix A, tensor product matrix B. What you do is you run over the different elements of A, and you multiply each element by the whole matrix B. This gives you a huge matrix. So let's have a look at that, how we would do it in practice. So first, I'm going to define E as the identity. E means identity here. I don't use I because I is taken, or something else in Julia. Actually, let me show you what happens when I use I. So turns out that I, it's a uniform scaling something, so I don't want to touch this one. Okay, so E. E will be the identity operator on a single spin. Similarly, I can define sigma x, but you quickly get tired of saying sigma x, so I just write x to mean sigma x, and it will be this matrix. And I can introduce another matrix, and then A. And then, just to show you the example of what happens if we take the tensor product of the identity with this matrix, that would be the expression. And so let's try to see whether that's, now we introduce this function cron. Okay. Cron supposedly will do the tensor product of identity times A for us. And let's check. And indeed, that's what we get. We get two copies of A on the diagonal, which would be the result of that. Let's try now X times A. So what we expect here is that we will get two copies of A, but off the diagonal. So let's have a look. Okay. So again, the idea is you just keep playing until it works. That's at least how I program with Julia. That can take a lot of time. All right, so yeah, you have a number of examples in this notebook so that you can convince yourself that it's doing what it should be doing. Excellent. So now we're ready to talk about a Hamiltonian or a spin chain. We're going to start with just three spins. And the idea is that, you know, we want to say the Hamiltonian is something like this, so sigma x on the first spin times sigma x on the second spin, and so on. Okay? But we need to first understand what this expression means, because every single object here that we are adding together, it's actually an 8 times 8 matrix. Okay? So every time that I don't mention, say, the third spin or the first spin in these expressions, every time I don't mention spin, it means there is the identity acting there. Okay? So here, actually, what it means is the tensor product of sigma x on the first spin, sigma x on the second spin, and the identity on the third spin. And we just omit the identity when we write it like this, but it's there. And when we try to write this big matrix for the Hamiltonian, we'll have to include it. Very good. So I think that all we want to try from now is just to write this Hamiltonian. So the physics of this Hamiltonian is we have three spins. And the first spin talks to the second one through this interaction. The second to the third one through this interaction. The third with the first one through this interaction. And then on each spin, we have a magnetic field in the z direction. So the question is, how do we write this metric? Yes, good.
The fourth term is it has less element than the first three.
Right. So every time, you mean that this only involves one spin?
The matrix are just two.
Very good. So this is 2 by 2.
Yeah.
And this?
4 by 4. Yeah.
Except that what I was saying is that every time that you see a spin missing, you have to think that it's in the identity. So let's write it. Let's write it. So. When we have, say, the number of spins in the spin chain, right? We have spin 1, spin 2, spin 3, and they have some interactions. Okay? So the total number of spins is 3. What we know is that this Hamiltonian is a matrix which is 8 times 8, meaning that it's a tensor product. Right, it's acting on the dimension. Maybe I should not have stopped with two spins, but in general, for n spins, the vector space of n spins is going to be the tensor product of the space for one spin times another times, etc., n times. Okay, n times. Now the dimension for for n equal to 1, the dimension is 2. For n equal to, so for 2 spins, the dimension is 4. For 3 spins, the dimension is 8. Right? For instance, for n equal to 3,
the expression here, for example, the first term,
yes.
Sigma 1 x, tensor product sigma 2 x,
yes.
This is 4 times 4.
Right. So you should complain. But what I tried to say before is that every time you see that, you have to imagine that there is times the identity on any other spin that I didn't mention. So what that expression really means is the following. I'm going to only write the first two terms and then dot, dot, dot. That expression really means the following. Sigma 1 x times sigma 2 x times identity 3. The second term is identity 3, 1, times sigma x2 times sigma x3. Okay? Dot, 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 and now we have plus h, and now let's write the first term. It says sigma z1, right? Which actually means times identity 2 times identity 3, plus etc. So we should write things this way. Nobody ever writes things this way. Why? Because if you look, if you follow the rule of complete every single term with as many identities as needed, you see that all the information that I have in here is already contained in that expression, right? So for instance, sigma z2 should be tensor product of identity on 1, sigma z2 on 2, identity on 3. Okay, so that's the convention. That's how we write things. Yes?
It seems like you always arrange them in the order 1, tensor product 2, tensor product 3, right?
Yes.
But the third term that starts with the sigma of a third spin twice there.
Why is that? It's because this was an expansion of a even more compact expression. So the more compact expression says h is equal sum over I, side I, of sigma I, or spin I, x times sigma I plus 1 x plus h sum over I of sigma z I, where n plus 1 is defined when I is equal, this I plus 1, this index, for I equal to n plus 1 is equal to 1. Okay? So usually you will see this expression. And what you have to do is you have to unpack it in this way and then fill the identities that are not written.
And where do I know where to fill the identities? Just by keeping. So for the third term, you would put the identity in front of.
I would actually, no, this, so the numbers here tell you exactly where the sigmas go. So it would be this term, when you try to expand it, is sigma x1, identity 2, sigma x3.
Ah, I see.
Okay. So usually people don't explain that. Yes. Yes.
So meaning if you the chain right here, it's the same thing?
No, it's not the same. I'm saying the meaning of this expression, once you put indices here, is this is the first one, and this is the third one. And there is an identity in between. All right, so we want to build an 8 times 8 matrix that looks like that. And that's the goal, what we're going to try to accomplish next. Yes.
We usually stop at 5 to 2 so that people can go to the colloquium. I didn't mention it to you before. So you have tons of time left, but I just wanted to mention it now.
Good, thanks. Yes, we'll, good. We'll be fine though. So, yeah, and then I realized that there are many different cute ways of writing the identity operator in Julia. I was amazed how many different ways you have. And so one option was what we did before, right? You can just write the matrix explicitly, the elements 1, 0, 0, 1. But then, there we are. So Another possibility is to just fill this with ones and then make the diagonal of that. And that's the one I'm going to follow next. So let's see. Do we? What I've done here is this is the identity operator, sigma x operator, sigma z operator. Now I want to take the tensor product of two identity operators, but I just build it directly as a diagonal matrix with four ones, the four times four diagonal matrix with four ones in the diagonal. Now this is the interesting expression. So here what we're doing is we're taking the tensor product of sigma x times sigma x. Okay, that's how it looks. And then what we want to do is we want to build all this guy, this 8 times 8 matrix, and we are going to do it term by term. So what I call here HXX will contain the, it's already the sum of three terms, this term plus this term. Let me call this HXX. And remember, we were missing a sigma 1 x identity sigma 3 x. So that's that. Hopefully, you can recognize this in this expression, right? First term, second term, third term on the blackboard. Good. And so, and now the second part is the magnetic field. So this is HZ, and it's going to be Z11 plus 1Z1 plus 11Z, where you can see that I started writing the identity just as a bar, okay? So that is how, what this HZ is. Excellent. So now we just put the two terms together. If you, you know, you can check, you can see on the screen that, for instance, this Hamiltonian. Oh, whoa, what's that? Wait. Yeah, yeah. I don't know how this ended up here. Maybe. Yeah, it should be EE. It's funny, I ran this and it worked. I don't know how. All right, now it's fine. So let me check again. So we define this guy and this guy. And now all we do is the full Hamiltonian is the sum of the two terms. Did I include a small magnetic field already, H, small h? No, I didn't. So in general here, we will have some magnetic field, H, which I'm going to set to 1. And so H times the matrix. So let's break this into two cells. And on the first cell, we'll just define a matrix. So we can have a look at it. OK, so this is the famous Hamiltonian for the IZ model for three spins, OK, for magnetic field equal to 1. So we've built it as the product, as the sum of two contributions, the interactions and the magnetic field. And you see it's a 8 times 8 matrix. And now at this point, we can forget how we created this and just use eigenvalue decomposition. Okay. So let's do that. And we get eigenvalues, eigenvectors. And now we decide to choose. So you know, this is just a matrix. We can eigenvalue decompose it. And now what we can do is we can repeat this for different values of the magnetic field. So we are going to see how the spectrum of eigenvalues depends on this magnetic field. Okay, we're going to consider, instead of the original Hamiltonian for H equal to 1 here, we're going to change the magnetic field H so that it takes different values. So that's what I'm doing here. This is the maximum value, 2. We're going to go from 0 to 2 in small steps. We'll take 20 steps. So we have an array of possible values for the magnetic field from 0 to 20. Oh, sorry, from 0 to 2. And then what we can do is repeat this diagonalization. And let's try this. And every time we diagonalize the Hamiltonian, we're just going to keep the lowest energy. Okay. But this is the smallest eigenvalue, and we put it in some, we store it in some array. And the point of doing that is that then we're going to use plot, pi plot, and we're just going to plot the low energy as a function of the magnetic field. And there you are. Maybe I'll try to make this smaller now. Yeah. Okay. So as a result of this, instead of diagonalizing one Hamiltonian, we've diagonalized a family of Hamiltonians, and for each, which as a function of the magnetic field, this is the magnetic field from 0 to 2. For each value of the magnetic field, we had a different Hamiltonian. We've diagonalized it, looked at the lowest energy state, lowest energy, and we plot this lowest energy here. Okay. Now, this is the best you can do if you just deal with three spins. It turns out that at h equal to 1, right here, something really strange happened for large n, for a large spin chain. There will be a quantum phase transition. And we'll be seeing that. But if you look at this plot at the moment, you see nothing. Okay? Nothing spectacular happens at this value. Okay? So our goal is to develop some tools for the rest of this module that will lead us to be able to see a phase transition happening right there. And what we need to do basically is to consider more spins. Okay? So we'll learn how to consider more spins. So we'll build Hamiltonians corresponding to n equal to 10 spins. This is a big matrix. It's 2 to the n times 2 to the n, so 1,000 times 1,000 roughly. And eventually we'll get to n equal to 20 spins or even 30 spins. But at that point, we cannot build a matrix. The matrix will be too large to put it in the computer. So we'll try to investigate ways of still being able to compute the ground state energy. And eventually, we'll see that something really strange is happening at h equal to 1. And this will be a quantum phase transition. And in particular, we'll see that the spin chain starts to behave as a quantum field theory. Okay, it will behave, start to behave as a conformal field theory. So this is lots of physics. I will try to go light on that side, just tell it, announce things. But the important thing is that we will develop all the tools, numerical tools, to see this happen. And I think that that's a good place to stop it. Do you have questions? OK, so what's going to happen is that this notebook, this first notebook, will go to the GitHub. Yes?
I can do that if you email it to me.
Okay.
Yes, for you.
Okay.